but the Ellie, the evil witch that he had sort of had a tryst with when he was away fighting in World War II. Oh, we missed this whole backstory. Mm-hmm. She had been torturing Cora and also his dad, apparently, yeah, and had turned him into a horse, mm-hmm, and was riding him around. Anyway, so she had returned the body of his dad, and then they had a sweet moment, and then he died. But anyways, they're taking the body of his dad to the consecrated church. And at one point, the Crooked Man calls on the body of his dad because he was like, what was he, a drunk or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he was like, you were a drunk and you were a sinner. And mm-hmm, so his dad turns into a zombie and yeah, attacks them. And so it was like, first of all, the, oh my God, oh my God, the trauma. And but it was so neat.
Yeah.
That was so, so smart. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, definitely. And that reminded me, too, of the turning people into animals, how Cora, I guess her name was,
her familiar was a raccoon, a baby raccoon.
Well, no, she got turned into a raccoon.
Oh, wait, I thought that was her doing that on purpose? No, well, no.
Tom's wife, what was her
Cora, name? Cora.
Yeah. No, that was she doing that? I thought she had been turned into a raccoon by the evil young witch.
But she came back on her own. So, unless she, I know that she had been tormented by, so Ellie was the blonde hot witch, and Cora was Cora was Tom's first girlfriend or something like that.
And she was kind of a witch, too.
She was a witch, too. Yeah, everybody's a witch. Everybody's a witch.
But I thought Cora was basically,
she was a good witch,
turning
though,
her into a raccoon.
Ellie's a bad witch.
Yeah.
So you think Ellie was turning Cora into a baby raccoon. Mm-hmm. So, so at one point they go to see Cora and they see her unfilled skin sack, mm-hmm, body. Like, her body looks like a rubber body. It has, mm-hmm, no bones, no meat. It's just like hollow.
Yeah.
But it looks like it looks like rubber. It doesn't, mm-hmm, look gross. It looks like rubber. Yeah. And then they're like, and then Tom's like, well, I guess she's out walking around. Mm-hmm. I guess we just wait for her. And I was like, okay. And then this little baby raccoon comes back and goes into her mouth and then fills out the body. And, mm-hmm, then it's Cora. And but she did writhe in pain a lot,
yeah,
which kind of makes it seem like she, but I didn't know if it was like she chose to go out as a baby raccoon and then just her coming back to her body was really painful, but she didn't.
No, but I got the impression
she was,
I think,
part of the torture that Ellie, yeah, was inflicting on her.
Yeah, I think it was intended that she was doing that to her and messing with
and
her.
Then with Tom's dad, Ellie had a magic bridle. Is that how you pronounce it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because I've only seen it written. that turned him into a horse, and then she rode around, and then she was very explicit about it. She's like, I've been riding this guy, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, Jesus, Ellie, what the fuck are you doing? And then the little backstory there is that Tom was sweet with Cora. Mm-hmm. They were together. But then he met Ellie, who was this gorgeous blonde witch. Mm-hmm. And then he became really enamored with her, yeah, kind of forgetting about Cora.
Well, and she kind of seduced him and, like, probably did some magic.
Well, according to the fucking scene, it was all she did was be hot by the river. Yeah, and that was enough.
Yeah.
And of course, the huge backstory is that she was like, hey, man, you want to get in on this with Crooked Man? And Tom was like, wow, you can get all sorts of powers. Let's, mm-hmm, do it. And then she got him to perform a ritual that called him and then provided him with a magical bone.
Yeah.
And so the whole movie is about Crooked Man trying to get back that magical bone. Because, yeah, once he got that bone and he saw the Crooked Man, Tom was freaked out and he was like, I don't want this. I'm sorry. I'm out. I'm out. Yeah. I'm out. And so he runs away and then he joins the army and leaves to fight in World War II.
Yeah.
And then he's returned to sort of settle shit.
Yeah.
And while he was away, Ellie's been torturing Cora and has been apparently torturing his father as well.
Yeah. And so eventually they just find out that there's stuff, they're underground under the church in the mines. There's,
oh yes. So in the beginning of the movie, the spider that was the asset, Hellboy beat the shit out of it, and then it turned into a little baby spider, mm-hmm, a little tiny regular size spider, and then it went down a grate, and they were like, "What is there a grate in the fucking mountains?"
Yeah,
and then the scientist lady was like, "Oh well, it's coal mining country, mm-hmm, and so there's probably a vast network of tunnels for ventilation and also for mining."
Yeah,
and so. If I remember correctly, the magic of the Appalachian Mountains, which is like an organism in itself, and the tunnels, it's, you know, nervous or cardiovascular system or whatever they called it, mm-hmm, was feeding into Crooked Man.
And it kind of was a portal to hell, the mines.
That, right. And that's why they built that church over the, over the big it. Opening. Yeah.
Yeah. To keep the whatever it was in there from coming out.
There were a lot of details that I missed. It was a very smart movie, and I've only, it was this smart, and I'm only this smart. So.
But in fairness, the movie, if I had to criticize the movie, it told the story in a way that was a little bit hard to follow because they kind of like, stuff would happen and then they'd give you some story and then stuff would happen and they'd give you some story and then stuff would happen. And it kind of did that, like,
so they gave you the information afterwards rather than like you didn't, you went through scenes without understanding what was happening and then the explanation came later, which means that you had, and there, and then there's no time to really stop and analyze what you'd seen and how it connects with the explanation. So that was true, though. You're right. Where I was like, what's happening now?
And I even watched it twice. And on the second one, it definitely,
everything clicked a lot more.
Yeah, but even still, it was sort of hard, a little bit hard to follow, even on the second view.
I'm glad you're saying that, because I thought it was on me. I thought I was dumb. And I was like, I can't follow what's happening.
No. It was definitely. And just, I think the piecemeal way that they gave the story meant also that you would sort of forget things. Mm-hmm. And then they would give you more info, and then you would kind of have to remember how it tied. And it was a little bit wonky,
I always blame myself.
This is a good movie, but it did was a bit hard to follow. And they did have, there would be long stretches of just quiet scenes without really people talking. And then there would be, you know, a lot of exposition and dialogue. That was another way that it kind of alternated back and forth. And so once you'd been in those quiet scenes for a while and then you come back to the dialogue scenes, it was kind of like, oh, that's right. We're doing this thing with this story. But yeah, it was a little bit hard to follow. So
still fantastic.
Yep. And so eventually they end up defeating the crooked.
They run him out of the area. So when the big
how do they defeat?
So when they're in the church, and the big way that they get out of the church. Oh my God, they have that great. There was a great scene where the crooked man's trying to tempt everybody in the party to give up Tom. And so he makes all sorts of promises. And at some point, he tries to tempt the priest with youth and vision, because the priest is very, very old and he is blind.
Yep.
And so he turns him into a young man and he gives him back his vision. And oh, that was such a good scene, because you could, like, can you imagine, like, if you're, you know, I think the priest was in his, like, 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And so he turns him into, like, a 25-year-old man or 30-year-old man. Mm-hmm. There's a scene where it goes from blurry vision to clear vision, and he's looking at his hands and he realizes that. Oh, and he also tries to tempt him with, like, because I guess, like, they implied that even though he never gave in to temptation, he was very heavily tempted by young women in his parish, like that when he was when the church was active and there were, like, young women around, he was like, oh. But they also imply that he never gave in to that temptation, but that, you know, and there was this one particular young woman who, like, particularly caught his eye or whatever. So he was thoroughly tempted, which was really cool. Where was I going with this? Oh, yeah. So they carve a cross onto a shovel with the bone, and then Hellboy uses that shovel to defeat all the zombies, which he is able to do so with one swing that doesn't connect with anybody.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. And then he takes this shovel, and then he decapitates Crooked Man. But it doesn't really kill him. It just turns him into a crow again, and then he flies away.
Yeah, yeah. Because, of course, he's a demon or the devil, so you can't really just send him back to hell. And so, yeah, no, it was very good movie. And also, you know, just in terms of, this is a random comment, but in terms of the low budgetness of the movie, I thought we were going to see, or I didn't think, I was wondering if we were going to see other BPRD members, like
we did
Dave
not.
Sapien.
Oh, you know, right, yeah.
Or characters like that, which we did not. And I was like, oh, right, of course, we're not really, because this movie's too low budget to have other characters besides Hellboy.
Where I think the whole special effects budget went on, was spent on the look for Hellboy.
Yeah.
And then the people that went aerial.
Yeah.
That's it. Oh, and the big ass spider.
And another thing I wanted to, another random thing I wanted to bring up was that this movie was also very much reminding me of the Evil Dead TV show.
Yeah.
It felt, the whole kind of feel and look and like the level of the production and everything.
The color saturation and the editing. Yeah, a little bit.
Very similar. And this felt like,
I miss Bruce Campbell.
It was like, this was, felt like a high budget TV show. You know, it's like low budget movie, high budget TV show.
I thought it was really good though. I mean, these days it's hard to tell the difference, tell you the truth. I mean, sincerely, the only difference is the amount of money spent, of course, but it's outlandish. It's either like an Avengers movie or, you know, like, I don't know, like a single camera sitcom. Yeah. It's like the range is so wide, but I mean, like with TV shows, like Game of Thrones and shit, like that line is super blurred. Mm-hmm. Like you can definitely have super high quality TV shows that blur the line between like the production level a movie can get to.
Yeah, yeah.
And also we've already seen a lot of shitty movies too, because it goes both ways. Yeah. That means that people can make really shitty movies a lot easier now and distribute them on Netflix or Amazon.
And unlike we did a review for the VHS Beyond, where it felt like that was a movie that was kind of favoring the production value of the movie more than the writing. But I feel like this movie, the writing is what carried it through, because it was very, as we're mentioning it, it's low budget, but it does look good.
I didn't hate the production, though. I thought it looked really good.
No, it looked good. It was all good, but the writing was, like, I think the strongest.
100%.
The storytelling was the strongest part.
In the story, though, the story called for dilapidated church. Boom. Easy. It called for, let's hang out in the woods. Boom. Easy. It called for a dilapidated mansion with creepy, dusty, like old tables. So nothing in the movie really called for something really lavish and like and expensive. I mean, there's a helicopter ride, there's a train scene, but, you know, and I'm guessing that's where all the money went, because, and we were talking in there, walking through impoverished Appalachian communities, so, like, that's not going to cost too much either, you know, so, and it was filmed in Bulgaria, so, it didn't, like, the story itself didn't call for big, lavish expenditures, with the exception of the potentially CGI, AI, or whatever. Yeah. And the name recognition actors that were involved, which weren't very many.
Yeah. And there were, what was funny too, is when I was watching this movie, there were definitely times where, and this is also from watching the other Hellboy movies, there was at least two or three distinct points in the story where it felt like in a Hollywood version, in the Guillermo del Toro, this would be the part where a big fight scene would break out and there would be like a whole big elaborate fight between Hellboy and something or whatever. And it was just like every time that part happened, the only big fight is in the beginning against the spider, where it's like a traditional action like Hollywood thing.
Great way to start a movie, by the way.
Yeah. But there were points where it was just like, if this were a bigger budget Hollywood movie, this would be a big action set piece. But then in this movie, it's like, it almost happens and then it just doesn't, you know? And it's like, okay, like that's actually fine. But it was very funny because it was just like, you insert action set piece here at moments, like when he gets thrown through the wall near the end of the movie.
Right. That's good.
But yeah.
Can you remind me why they went to the old mansion?
I can't remember.
There's a reason they have to go to this old mansion. And
maybe it's where he lived or something, the Crooked Man.
Maybe, because, I mean, like, they walk in on this, like, cool, they call it soirees. I always thought the rich had these crazy soirees, and they're like, that's what it looks like. Really cool, fancy table that's all been covered in dust and grime, and everything's got maggots. But incidentally, see, that's the thing that they always get wrong in these movies, is that if you have maggots, it's because you got flesh that's that can be eaten by a maggot, which means it can only be, like, maybe a couple months old.
True. Yeah, true. They always have to have maggots.
I know. Maggots are such a... Isn't that interesting, like, that maggots are such an integral part of the horror movie, genre?
It's like Hellraiser, you know? Yeah. The maggots and the food when they go to the house in Hellraiser. And it's just like, yeah.
But yeah, maggots only come at a very specific time during decay. Like, you can't just have them around all the fucking time.
Yeah. And so then also they... And this felt a little bit shoehorned. They... with the character of the BPRD agent, they kind of shoehorn in a story with.
I had about to look up why it was important for her to go into the tunnels.
Yeah,
and take the priest
whole
with
thing
her.
With like her father dying and stuff like that.
Right. Oh, I think that was because Cora had told her, like, when you really put a piece of yourself into a spell, then it makes it really strong. And so she had to recall, like, a traumatizing time. Right. I think that's right, right? And so that's where she was like, oh, because she comes face-to-face with the spider.
Yeah.
Because the spider, surprise, which was a cool, like, I totally had forgotten about the spider, by the way.
Yeah,
it was. And so it was like, surprise, we got a big-ass spider to deal with again. And so she had to create that spell. But I guess the spell saved her from the spider, but also kind of affected the Crooked Man, which is why Hellboy was able to beat the shit out of him.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he was about to kind of defeat them. Oh, because he had them trapped in a hallucination.
Yeah.
That's right.
Right, yeah, yeah. And very Lord of the Rings, where she creates the light to defeat the spider, which is very much like... the Two Towers movie where Frodo has the light that he defeats the giant spider with. I just kept thinking Lord of the Rings.
I actually missed that, but you're right. there was this one part where I felt really bad. There's a scene where the priest and the scientist go down into the tunnels to try to, because she remembers, like, hey man, this is a vital, these are vital lifelines for the mountain, which are feeding the mountains, which are feeding the Crooked Man. This is where we can defeat him. And so they both go down there. Oh, there was a really funny line where he's like, you want to do a spell in the tunnels? Are you motherfucking out of your mind? I was like, oh, it's so funny and cute. Because, I mean, they've gone through some crazy shit. So for him to say that at that point, it's kind of funny. Anyway, but so he goes down there and he gets attacked by a bunch of crows. And the really... I felt really ashamed that I had this thought because it was like a knee-jerk thought. He's getting attacked by crows, and then the crows, like, eat his eyes, like, first. And then my thought was like, well, he wasn't really using them. But then they kind of fuck him up really bad and kill him. So I was like, oh, yeah, he's not coming back from that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I guess, like, the whole point of them going down into the tunnels was to sort of create a distraction or to weaken the Crooked Man enough for Hellboy and Tom to defeat him, which they do. And the big defeating part is that they throw him down some stairs and then all of the pennies fall out of him.
Yeah.
Boom. I was kind of expecting a little more, but I guess that was not bad.
Yeah. It was, yeah, it was okay. It worked as an ending, but it was kind
of
random.
It was full of pennies. It was full of souls. Okay.
So, and then, you know, and that kind of goes along with another small complaint I have, which is that...
The motive for Crooked Man to go after Tom in the first place?
Yeah, and just kind of the more of the lore of the story as we, you know, talk about lore in terms of, like, why... Well, one thing is, like, in the comics and in the Guillermo del Toro movies, Hellboy is kind of an expert on folklore, and he's extremely knowledgeable about, you know, everything kind of connected with mythology and folklore.
That's awesome.
And so I was a little disappointed that the character of Hellboy didn't chime in more. Usually he will speak
more. He was dismissive of lore, actually, at the beginning.
And that's a little bit out of character for him because he actually should be chiming in and giving info about what's happening. And not only that, but he should be knowledgeable about how to defeat these things and how to counter these things. Because that's a big part of Hellboy. It's like he carries a lot of stuff on him.
Did they use that in the Guillermo del Toro movies? I feel like that was a part of, like, a feature of his identity or something.
Yeah, like he carries... mystical, like, talismans and reliquaries, and
here, like, he was like a big old bodyguard.
Yeah, and he knows, like, it's like, you know, very weird niche folklore mythology things, okay. like iron, like fairies don't like iron, and you know, if you want to turn a fairy like back into its original fairy form, then you would like touch it with an iron, something iron.
What are the other fairy forms that they can turn into?
Well, they can shapeshift.
Oh.
One of the things in classic, like, British mythology mm-hmm. is that fairies will impersonate babies.
I did hear about that, yes.
They take the baby to fairyland, and mm-hmm. then a fairy...
They switch out babies for themselves, turns, yeah.
makes themselves look like a baby and replaces them with, yeah.
To what end?
Just to fairy mess shit. With people, yeah.
Fairy shit.
But he is... And so he was, yeah, he was a little too dismissive of that stuff and not...
That was one scene, but yeah, you're right.
And I kind of wanted the, like, exposition scenes of Hellboy explaining why or what they need to do to defeat, you know,
yeah, the Green Man. I already have in mind the scoring that I'll give this movie, but one thing that I liked, it gave, you know, certain movies can give you a sense of wonder or really high hope, and the movie... This movie was good at that because it's the reboot of a future series of movies.
Yeah.
Hopefully nothing stands in the way of that because this was such a good movie and I'm so excited to see more. But it was very much so like an installment in the life of Hellboy.
Yeah.
You know, it had nothing to do with Hellboy for the most part. I mean, there were some elements where he's connecting with his mom, but it was very much so like, this is the first and there will be many or there will be more. Yeah. And so that was really, really exciting. But I have seen movies do it a little better too. And the only way that I can gauge it, because I couldn't verbalize it in an intelligent way, but the only way that I can gauge it is the level of excitement that I felt, which on a scale of 1 to 10, it was a solid 8, but yeah. I've had like movies that took me up to like a 10.
Yeah.
So it got me excited for future Hellboy movies, and it did that really well. But I think I have seen it done a little more excitingly.
Yeah. And yeah, I was thinking that is that this is a perfect sustainable way to do mm-hmm. Hellboy. Because it's
episodic.
Instead of having it be the huge, big budget Hollywood movies, which it's too niche of a concept mm-hmm. to be a big Hollywood thing. It makes far more sense for the stories to be these smaller stories. And that's more accurate to the comic anyways.
Nice.
This is the kind of thing, like, the interesting thing about the Hellboy comics is that the kind of outer shell of the stories are these big kind of world-ending concepts,
mm-hmm.
but the stories themselves are always super small and usually only involve a couple of characters in a small, isolated
Neat.
Location.
I like that.
And so it's perfect for doing lower-budget horror movies instead of big-budget superhero movies, for sure.
Very nice.
Yeah. And so, yeah, no, I hope they make more like this and keep going with this, because there's lots of others. Like I said, this is based on an actual comic story, which none of the other movies are. Well, they kind of are. They're roughly based on the stories, but heavily altered. This one is very much like actually based on the tone and style of the actual story. And so there's lots of other stories similarly, you know, that could be low budget horror mm-hmm. movies and be done well. So hopefully this gets out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was you know, like I said, the expectation for this movie was extremely low, I think, among most people.
That's incredible.
And so...
Even with the Mignola name mm-hmm. attached?
Well, I don't know that people necessarily know. There was very little marketing or promotion for this movie.
Yeah, I never heard of it until you brought it up.
Yeah, no, it feels like... Because I think of the massive lack of success of the last movie, reboot it,
okay.
I think the expectations were so low that nobody wanted to even bother.
Ouch.
And so, yeah, no, I hope, because the reviews, I looked, and the reviews are all positive, mm-hmm. and if you go to, like, Amazon and look at the reviews for the streaming or the DVD version, mm-hmm. it's like it's at like 4.5 or 5 stars almost, and all the reviews are very positive, and all the reviews also point out that this is the most accurate Hellboy story in terms of you know, if you're a fan of the comics, then this is the best one of the series.
Neat.
And so hopefully it gets out there and it's successful and they make more of these.
It's interesting because I was going to argue that because the original creator was involved, that should have sort of signaled to everybody that it was going to be a good movie and get it like put on everybody's radar.
Yeah.
But you know, there are several adaptations that have not been great, and but were really that were really that really connected with the original material,
right,
source data. Like, for example, there's that The Shining TV series with that guy from Wings.
Mm-hmm.
That was not great.
Mm-hmm.
It was not good. But everybody's like, oh no, yeah, I really stuck to the story. Because mm-hmm. I mean, like the Kubrick version was very disconnected from the source material. But the TV series was supposed to be like dead on, but it was still like, ew.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not necessarily a stamp of approval just to have something be really true to the source material.
No, definitely. That doesn't automatically make it good for sure. And sometimes stuff has to change because when you're adapting like a novel to a movie, how you tell a story in a novel is completely different than how you tell a story in a movie.
Right.
And so you can't make like a faithful adaptation of novels to movies. But I feel like with comics, comics are so close to being like movies and TV shows since it's a visual. It's
a shorter gap to bridge.
Yeah. So it is, I think, easier to remain more faithful and have it be good.
They're already so stylized and visual that mm-hmm. it's, I mean, like, I feel like a Mignola, am I saying this right? Mm-hmm. He's already a director. Like, he's already what are the other jobs? There's cinematic. No, there's...
One of the big side jobs that comic book artists do, and Mike Mignola did as well, is being a storyboard artist.
There we go, storyboard,
yeah.
There's storyboard, there's the person who's like looking at the thing, the way the scene is set. What are those called? What are those people called?
Well, I mean, the director is one of the...
Well, there's director.
Or cinematographer.
Yeah, cinematographer. Thank mm-hmm. you very much. So cinematographer, there's editors, there's directors. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, with graphic novelists, like they're doing all those jobs already.
Yeah, you're laying out
storyboard,
the shots.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. It's one of... Being a storyboard artist, like these comic artists who do that,
mm-hmm.
it's a bit of
you're
an
framing
under,
visuals, yeah.
Like they are creating visuals that the director will... a lot of the times end up using. So in a lot of ways, yeah, it's like, it's kind of an underrated or under talked about field because mm-hmm. they really are. A lot of times there is no visual representation at the point that the storyboard artist is creating the storyboard.
Mm-hmm.
And they often are working with the directors, of course, but the storyboard artist in a lot of ways is the person who is like putting the first visual representation mm-hmm. of the movie into reality. You know,
it's such a different animal than just a straight up like novel where really like it's words that incite feelings mm-hmm. rather than visuals that incite. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you can paint a you can paint a picture. Certainly.
Yeah.
It's complicated. It's complicated.
That's got to be one of the reasons why Hollywood loves adapting comic books because
it's easy.
It's literally already
done.
Laid out for you. Totally. It's just like half the job is done
already. Get me the hottest actor and actress that can fill these roles. Boom. Make it happen.
One of my favorite things that just reminded me is and I'm 99% sure I'm right about this, but I haven't looked in a while, but The storyboard artist for From Beyond, which is, you know, From Beyond mm-hmm. is basically the sort of spiritual sequel to Reanimator created
right.
by all the same people and same actors are in From Beyond as Reanimator. But I noticed in the credit that the storyboard artist for From Beyond is John Byrne, and John Byrne is like a super famous Spider-Man artist. He did like
really?
A ton of the Spider-Man comics in the like 60s and 70s. So it's like you have like really big legendary visual artists who are basically creating, not only are they creating the like look and feel of the movie.
The movement, the because I mean, like every shot is a special perspective or angle, mm-hmm. and every character in it is posing in certain ways to sort of emote different feelings. And it's fucking a deep art. Like it's a very complicated deep art, and I don't think people like give it that much credit.
Totally, and even to a certain extent, they're also designing the sets and like props because. You know, the look of the rooms and the objects that people are using and holding are also drawn by them. So it's like if you have some weird piece of machinery, you know, that artist is basically creating the first iteration of what that thing mm-hmm. will look like in the movie.
I earlier I said emote, but I meant illicit. But I'm correcting myself.
And just since we're talking about storyboard artists and comic book artists, Mike Mignola... it was the storyboard artist on that Treasure Island Disney animated movie that came
out. They came, when?
It was a sci-fi version of...
What decade?
Or the Atlantis. It has the word Atlantis in it, but he did it like a... He was the storyboard artist on a Disney movie from like the late 90s.
Oh, that was the dark ages of Disney, the between the late 80s and the 90s.
Yeah.
And by dark ages, I mean that they made movies that weren't blockbusters.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they weren't good.
And this movie was not a blockbuster.
I remember so Atlantis, the one with the nerdy guy with the glasses, and then the female lead was like the white haired indigenous character.
And they had
character.
Like a boat that kind of flew. It looked like a ship, but it kind of flew through space.
Maybe I didn't actually watch it. I'm just kind of going.
It was
off
definitely
of
that era where the movie was a flop. It was like a big.
But I remember like thinking like some of the stories I remember watching as a kid from Disney from that time. Like they weren't bad. They just like you know the cauldron and the blah blah blah. Like they weren't bad, but somehow they just didn't hit. Yeah. And I guess it's because they weren't marketable. I think that's what it is. Like if you can't capture like a kid's fucking design. Desire to buy a toy, they're not going to consider it good.
But I agree. But the point is, of course, is that Mike Mignola was himself a storyboard artist.
Neat. So, and it makes total sense for a comic book artist.
Yeah. And so, great movie overall. So I guess we should score. We can wrap it up.
Yeah. Wrap it up, B. Okay. I'm going to give it 4.5 stars. Some very minor criticisms, but also I think not the biggest criticism, but just that it's very much so the first installment of a series, and so it is by definition not gonna be the big review, like the big, you know, it's not meant to be the big star of the series because it's number one, and so I don't know if that's fair for me to do it that way then. I'm going to go with 4.5. I'm sorry. That's what it is. 4.5.
Nice. I'll be a little harsher and give it a 4. But even still, that's above average and definitely above average movie. It definitely is a legitimately good movie that everyone should watch.
Sorry. I think I can't articulate when I was saying that because it is the first installment, everything as well developed as the story was. And as well developed as the characters were presented, there was already always like an underdevelopment. Like this wasn't a Hellboy story. This wasn't like this was an offshoot story. And I think that if when you create that expectation of like, oh, this is a small story, but there's a bigger one to come, then I'm not gonna shoot my load. Let's go with 4.5.
But it also, and what's cool about that too is it kind of, and this, the comics are like this as well, where they can, a lot of these stories like this one, it's like Hellboy almost isn't the main character. It was almost that guy Tom.
It was Tom,
really the main
character. For sure.
And that is a common thing in these stories where it's like Hellboy is investigating something and it's more, the story is more about the characters that are directly involved in that story, and Hellboy is more of an investigator who shows up, and he's kind of there, and he's involved.
He's a detective.
But
he's a hardball detective.
But exactly. But a lot of times it is it's like the smaller characters who are directly connected with the events that are going on in the story who are like the main characters, and then Hellboy's just kind of there along with them. You know, almost like... the current Mad Max movies, where Mad Max is not really the main character.
No, not at all anymore.
Furiosa is the main character. And it's like that. And so that's cool for making future movies, because they can basically tell these different horror stories, and then it's like Hellboy is there. It's a Hellboy movie, but it's also... Because you could have... I feel like you could have had this movie just be the Crooked Man, and then have a horror story, just remove Hellboy and have the story just be Tom and the witches and figuring out how to defeat the witches.
This could have happened without Hellboy for sure. Yeah.
And so it ends up being almost like a cool anthology kind of idea, where you can tell different, really radically different types of stories in different areas with different tones and feels, but have Hellboy and have that overarching Hellboy connection, you know.
Well, I wholeheartedly hope that Mignola continues to get funding for these movies, because it was fantastic. I loved it so much. It was so great, and I hope that it doesn't get screwed up by you know studio politics and whatnot,
or just kind of missed, kind of overlooked,
bad marketing.
Hopefully it doesn't get overlooked, and people do find
bad
out about
marketing
this movie and they get,
oh, no marketing.
And I swear to God, it's like, for $20 million, they should absolutely be able to get the budget
for another
movie.
I bet they already made their money back. That's insane.
Yeah, it's got to be doing okay.
I'm pretty sure you can fart and make $20 million when you make a movie and like it goes out there, you know, and it's and it's got the name of Hellboy on it.
Yeah.
So I'm but yeah, we'll see how it all shakes out, right? Because I mean, there's many different pitfalls that can you know, really hold back a project, such as like, oh, well, you made tons of money, let's give you lots of money, but now we're really watching, and now we're really controlling everything you do, and now we're gonna screw it all up because we want to make sure the toys look like we want them to, and so who knows. Good luck, Mignola.
Yeah,
you did a good job, buddy.
Yeah, hopefully we'll get another one.
Yeah. All right, well, let's wrap it up. It's been a long one today. We went over time. It's fine. This is Fog City Horrors, operating out of radiovalencia.fm. thank you so much for hanging out with us. We will be now returning you to non-regularly scheduled programs. We'll just be going on to the Robo DJ until the next show comes on, which who knows when that's going to be. Thank you so much for hanging out with us, and have a good night, and happy Halloween.
A woman gets excited when you show her something new.
Her point of view demands an awful lot.
Fashion changes, passion ranges. From lukewarm to red hot. She's got her own clock without any cord. A battery clock that she can afford. She's ready to buy, anxious to try. When she sees our line,
oh my, oh my.
Confidentially, potentially, the sky is the limit.
And we've got the jump on everyone in it.
Transistor rise in the USA. Something nobody else can say. She'll hang 'em in the kitchen, hang 'em in the hall, hang 'em in the living room, wall to wall. Yes, we've got battery clocks that nobody's got. Our battery clocks are hotter than hot. The battery market is the main event, and all we want is 98%.
Mr. Claiborne, there's gotta be power. And I'm telling you, Ford will really give it to you.
More power to you with the Power Master, the Workmaster, and the Power Major, too. More power to you.
Ford provides the tractors that do more than any other tractors do.
The work on a farm is never done. It never lessens, shrinks, or diminishes.
There's always power. power punching, tractor crunching, big wheels turning, soils a churning.
Always onward, always forward.
It never finishes.
But the work on the farm is getting done with more efficiency and economy, as Ford helps lighten each chore, and this year more than ever before. More power to you with the Power Masters, the Word Master and the Power Major too. More power to you. Ford provides the tractors that do more than any other tractors do. Endurance and mobility, power and versatility, safety, dependability, that's Ford. More power to you with the Power Master, the Word Master, and the Power Major too. There's lots more power, more power for you.
Hi, this is Country Joe McDonald, and you're listening to Radio Valencia.
To you, I'm just the flavor to make I don't believe it. At least a pound of rice.
Acid rock, progressive rock, krautrock, out jazz, experimental music, electronica, the avant-garde, and sounds from various undergrounds, then you should tune in, turn on, and drop by the Sonic Subversion Show with Brian Cox every Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, right here on Radio Valencia.
We'll be right back. grumpy, my face and hands are dirty. Go on down to the backhand store and lay my money down. Get a plastic bottle of whiskey, got some friends coming around. I'm coming home. A plastic bottle of whiskey, and it's good to be alive. Well, that first shot of whiskey tends to be a little sharp, so I cut it with some cola and I pull out my harp. I might play some gospel, I might play the blues, maybe I'll play some Johnny Cash. Born to Lose, come and sing along. Plastic bottle of whiskey, I got nothing to hide. It's good to be alive.
This is Smelly Kelly from Red Meat, and when I'm in San Francisco, and that's all the fucking time, I listen to Radio Valencia, because they play that good roots shit. God bless you. Take care. Say hello to the childrens.
Car keys and collar made of aluminum.
To make them smile, it's got the style. It's gonna make all our sales reports hum.
It has appeal, and it's for real. It satisfies our most particular yen.
And with a key line that's in color, we're gonna bomb that market again. We'll sell them spritely, day and nightly.
We've got a winner now that really will do it.
Align with action.
Satisfaction.
National has got a winner, my friend.
Align with action, satisfaction.
National has got a winner, my friend. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
National's got a winner. National's got a winner. National's got a winner. National's got a winner. Nah. Nah.
It's all right?
It's all right.
It's all right.
National.
Here today to demonstrate a revolutionary way to calculate. It makes all competition obsolete. With this 1265, they can't compete. It's a whole generation ahead of them all. With so many exclusive features, I'm proud to recall.
It's small in size and half the weight of its average competition. And man, it's great. Its wizardry of circuitry will make it number one in the industry.